Well, thank you very much for the invitation to speak here, and it's a real pleasure to be here. And so what we've been talking about upstairs in the Bob Room for this week are a lot of arguments to the effect that in fundamental theories of gravity, proposed fundamental theories, we expect space-time to disappear, that there won't be space-time among the fundamental degrees of freedom of the theory. So I mention here several different arguments to the effect that space-time is not expected to be among the fundamental degrees of freedom. Just to pick one to illustrate, and you probably can fill these in on your own, many of you. The first one focuses on what could we mean by measuring, say, length or duration at the Planck scale. And so if you imagine taking a system and taking its mass all the way up to the Planck scale, this is the kind of argument that Arkani Hamed has given to say that space-time is doomed. If you try to take a system and move it up to the Planck scale, then you get all kinds of counterintuitive effects, like the Compton length associated with a mass of a certain size will be inside the Schwarzschild radius for that same mass. You'd think that you'd form a black hole before you're able to actually have a measurement system that would allow you to measure length at that scale. So it seems like for that kind of argument, you've established that operationally at the Planck scale, the notions of space and time are going to break down in some fundamental way. The other arguments give different kinds of conclusions, but they all indicate in different ways that some features of space-time disappear at the fundamental scale, and we need to then ask, how do we think about these fundamental theories that lack space-time entirely? And so that's why the title of the talk is In Search of Lost Space-Time. How do we think about space-time in these contexts? And as I say, I think I'm not going to be going through these arguments in detail, but I think each argument will point in different ways to aspects of or features of space-time that will seem to be problematic at these high energy scales. And so one of the hopes is that for a given candidate theory that doesn't have space-time among the fundamental degrees of freedom, that you'll be able to recover or give an account of how space-time emerges in some sense. So this is just one example. It's a picture from a paper by philosophers, Vince Lahm and Christian Wuthrich, about the causal set theory. And so on the left, you have a discrete structure, a causal set with an ordering relation. And the hope is that you will be able to map that structure into what's on the right, which is a space-time manifold that's familiar from classical general relativity. And so the hope is that for different candidate theories of quantum gravity, we can have a candidate theory, which I'm going to call throughout the TF, means T fundamental or T final, if you're more optimistic, that would include sort of non-spatiotemporal fundamental degrees of freedom, and that there's a higher level theory, and we're going to be focusing on general relativity in particular, that has classical space-time notions. And we're going to ask, in what sense can we say, and how can we clarify the idea that space-time emerges from a more fundamental theory? And a terminological warning. So emergence gets used in a lot of different ways. So it gets used in the philosophy literature to talk about other issues, such as how we think about consciousness in relation to the neural states of our brain. That's one area where people talk about emergence a lot. And in that context, there's often a distinction drawn between what's called strong emergence and weak emergence. So in a case of strong emergence, and this is kind of a first pass of the definition, I'm not going to dwell on this, but just to give you a sense of the contrast, for a case of strong emergence, the initial or less fundamental theory would be seen as being really autonomous or not derivable from the final theory. So it'd have a really striking degree of independence from the final theory. What's called weak emergence is weaker, as the name suggests. The idea is that it would have features, the initial or higher level theory has features that are qualitatively distinct from the final theory, and they might be unexpected or surprising as well. And so that would apply in this case where we imagine that the qualitatively distinct features are space-time itself re-emerging at the upper level. And so this talk, I'm really going to be focusing on philosophical issues around how we could derive the theory of classical space-time from some final theory candidate or fundamental theory candidate. And in that sense, this is a weak notion of emergence, but I think there's also the possibility that we will be able to elucidate the contrast between the two and that there would be novel and robust features that arise at the level of the initial theory. Now let me say that I think there's really, I don't know if you feel the intuitive pull of this, but ever since the 17th century, we've learned that the way we experience the world can be misleading in certain ways, and we've learned to think of colors and other features of our ordinary experience as not directly mapping onto the sort of physical features that we think are fundamental. On the other hand, space-time seems a little harder to get around. It does seem harder to imagine that you could have a non-spatiotemporal theory that would represent nature. So I don't know if you feel the intuitive pull. This is a philosopher who's discussed this, and I like this passage, but I think it captures the kind of feeling that maybe you share, that space-time seems more fundamental in some way. So I don't know if Larry Sklar is a philosopher of physics. He says, what could possibly constitute a more essential, more ineliminable component of our conceptual framework than that ordering of phenomena which places them in space and time? The spatiality and temporality of things is, we feel, the very condition of their existing at all and having other less primordial features. And then he briefly talks about color as not being quite as troubling, but a world not in time, a world not spatial, except to some Platonists, I suppose, such a world seems devoid of real being altogether. So I don't know if people find the pull of that, but I think there is a pull that it seems harder to imagine a fundamental theory without space-time completely, and this is just a nice encapsulation of that intuitive response. So as Nyesh said, I'm a philosopher approaching these topics. There's huge, technically challenging questions that are posed by this question. How can a non-spatiotemporal theory represent nature? How can we infuse the mathematics of such a theory with physical significance, such that it represents the world as we see it around us? And so there's a huge number of physical and technical challenges associated with answering this question. How do we recover general relativity as a limit? How do we satisfy core principles of general relativity and quantum field theory, and so on? But there are also interesting, and I think equally challenging, philosophical questions. So several of the central ideas that philosophers of science appeal to when we think about how scientific theories represent the world implicitly invoke space and time in the background. And so when we think about laws of nature, we often think of them as involving evolution through time. Well, if you don't have space and time, how do you think about the constraints imposed by laws? How do you think about composition in a theory with no space-time, and so on? So I think there's actually an equally intriguing set of questions about how does a theory of this sort represent nature if we have to change or modify these philosophical notions as well. And so, not surprisingly, because these are such interesting topics, it's drawn a lot of philosophers who are trying to reach beyond space-time to do some work. So Karen is one of the people here at the conference. That's her book from a few years ago. Beyond Space-Time is a project that's headed by Nick Huggett and Chris Wuthrick that really involves a number of philosophers and physicists. But there's a lot of philosophers who've been working on these topics for around a decade, who've been thinking about how do we formulate philosophy in a context where we're considering fundamental theories of quantum gravity, and what can philosophers really contribute to the effort. And so we've been talking this week, as Nyesh mentioned, about different approaches to quantum gravity. This is actually his list from the slide in which he opened the conference. There's a number of approaches to quantum gravity that are actively being explored. Obviously, this isn't meant to represent equal weights to all of the approaches. There's quite a bit different effort in different areas. But on the technical side, the question of how to recover space-time is going to be very different in each of these contexts, right? So the question of how to think about the emergence of space-time in causal sets is very different from how to think about the emergence of space-time in string theory, for example. And so there's a lot of interesting distinctive aspects of the derivations. If you ask about a perturbative approach, a non-perturbative approach, there's also people who've been interested in more like condensed matter approaches where you think of space-time emerging as a large n limit of some collection of an ensemble of non-spatial temporal entities. So there's a lot of really interesting questions that arise as you look in detail at the specific theories and ask, how does the reconstruction of space-time work in each one of those cases? So that's a really interesting project to sort of work through each of those. This is something that Nick Huggett and Chris Wutherick have started to pursue in a book, which they've been posting chapters from for a while, so hopefully the book will be done soon. I'm not going to take on, this is a very interesting project, I'm not going to take that on today. What I want to do, and perhaps you'll be disappointed to hear this, is to look at just a few general questions that I think arise across all of these different attempts to reconstruct space-time. And this will allow me to focus on some general philosophical questions, which I hope you'll find intriguing, which I think this case brings out. So again, this is not going to be a technical talk at all. First of all, a lot of people in the room will be better at some of these aspects than I am, so I'm not the one to be speaking about this. But I think there are some interesting philosophical topics that are arising here, and I'm hoping that you'll be intrigued to see what philosophers have been doing in this area. And I should be upfront about the fact that I'm really reporting, for the most part, on the body of work that's been done by a large group of people. So there's around a decade's worth of work of philosophers considering these questions. So let me state the three questions I'll be focusing on. So the first is just, how much does the current theory constrain or shed light on the fundamental theory that we're after? And here I'm going to be arguing against what I think are some philosophical myths that I don't know if they've influenced you, but I think they're pernicious myths that my field is responsible for. So I feel a kind of responsibility for clarifying them and responding to them. Second, what is needed for the empirical coherence of a final theory that doesn't involve space and time? So this is really the worry that was expressed in the quote by Sklar. How could a fundamental theory without space-time be a theory at all? And so I'll see this is reflected in the literature. I'll say more what I mean about empirical coherence in just a moment, but that's where I'm going with that question. And then the final one is, what is needed to establish the physical significance of the theory? How do we breathe life into the equations of the theory? Okay, and so those are the three parts of the talk. So let me first turn to the question of how constrained is the fundamental theory by the current theory? And we'd all like to imagine that we have enough experimental evidence to tie down the theorists, like Gulliver is tied down by the Lilliputians. And so we would hope that the fundamental theory, and I'm gonna call the initial theory the emeritus theory, we're imagining that it's being superseded by the new theory. So what is exactly the relationship between the fundamental theory and the theory that we're going to be treating as emeritus, because we've recognized it's no longer fundamental? And here's the two myths that I mentioned that I feel like this is a common view in philosophy that I hope hasn't persuaded everyone in physics, but insofar as it has, I think it's important to have those views disputed. One is that we have a prevalence of underdetermination of theory by evidence, that we always have to face up to this question of underdetermination. And secondly, there's a worry called incommensurability that was raised by Kuhn of actually not being able to use the same language once you've shifted from one theory to another, a kind of failure to be able to communicate as you make a transformation from one theory to another. And I think both of these are myths. So I think in response to underdetermination, there are cases where I think we can just have very clear empirical guidance that forces us to introduce a new empirical principle, or a new principle in a theory that's based on very strong evidence. And in terms of incommensurability, I just find that picture of how theory transition works completely incorrect. And I'll say a little bit more about why that is the case in just a minute. But let me first turn to the question of underdetermination. So I'm gonna use just one example here. It's a beautiful paper by John Norton, but what he was looking at is a case from the old quantum theory. So this is after Planck's results were well known. They're well known by around 1910, that if you assume the quantum discontinuity, that you can derive the appropriate formula for the black body radiation. I'm sure it's somewhere on this board here. I was looking before I came up, but I'm sure the formula is somewhere on the chalkboard here. So this was well known, but it was also plausible at that time, and Nernst and others asked themselves, do you have to assume this weird thing, the quantum discontinuity, in order to derive this result? Is there some other assumption we could make that's more sensible that would allow us to derive this result? And this is something that Poincaré and Ehrenfest both considered in 1911 and 1912. And what they're able to show is that with the common assumptions that people made about the statistical mechanics governing the resonators in a cavity and governing the radiation, just the very fact that experimenters had measured the black body radiation formula to be accurate could show you that you are forced to accept the quantum discontinuity, right? So it's, in that sense, the empirical result gives you very strong guidance. And so the different arguments by Poincaré and Ehrenfest have slightly different assumptions, but several of them are quite strikingly weak, so that they weren't in the position of saying, we don't know exactly what the underlying model would be that gives us this Planck distribution. We can actually show that you have to have quantum discontinuity as part of the solution in order to be able to recover the formula for black body radiation. So I think this is actually a common type of argument in physics, where you assume part of a theory, and then you're able to use empirical guidance that will force you to accept a new principle. Now, this is difficult reasoning, because often the new principle might be in conflict with the theory you started with, so you have to be careful about selecting parts of the theory that you're going to be committed to. But you can have very clear empirical guidance here, and I think this is stronger than the image we often have, which is just that we make predictions, there might be a lot of models, competing models that would be compatible with those, and so we choose the best one based on simplicity or beauty or what have you. I think in some cases you can do a lot better, that you can actually find really clear guidance about specific principles that you need to adopt, that your hand is really forced. And then the question is, are there arguments of this kind in quantum gravity? This might be harder. It's always easier to see these in retrospect, but you can see that Poincaré and Ehrenfest were running this argument in 1911 and 1912. This was well before quantum theory had been fully formulated. So they're in the midst of trying to deal with these results, and they're able to give arguments of this type. So I find it's an appealing style of argument if you can have it. And it's, I think, an effective response to standard worries about underdetermination. Now let me say something briefly about the idea of Kuhn, that in a scientific revolution, we should see theory changes prompted by the accumulation of anomalies over time, and that scientists through this revolutionary phase are unable to communicate because they're, and this is a direct quote, living in different worlds, right? So they adopt different languages that are so different that they have difficulty communicating with each other. So there's no way of sort of rationally resolving the dispute between them because of this conflict. I think this is just a wrong picture of how to think about theory change in science. When you look at the cases of historical theory change more carefully, what you find is that the people who are the revolutionaries were often the most well-versed in the previous view. Carlo had a nice passage that I like quoting, but I'll quote or paraphrase. Copernicus's De Revolutionibus was almost like a revised edition of Ptolemy's Almagest. Copernicus knew Ptolemaic astronomy inside and out, and that was what allowed him to criticize it and improve upon it. So the idea that there would be some distinct language that you know led him to fail to communicate is just not accurate. And so what we typically see instead is that the fundamental theory arises from a refinement and a careful critical analysis of the core ideas of the earlier theory. And so there's a challenge that is often being responded to, which is how to determine what is actually responsible for the empirical success of a theory. I think that's a really deep question as you have a theory which you recognize might have extraneous components, extra commitments that you don't want to take on, and you're trying to find the core that is actually responsible for the empirical success. But the people who are able to do that best are the people who are the most well-versed in the preceding theory. And I mention here two philosophers who've really advocated this line of argument, Howard Stein, and then my colleague at Western, Robert DeSalle, has a beautiful book where he gives a kind of conceptual analysis of changes in understanding in space-time up until the 20th century, where he really emphasizes this kind of approach. Okay, so I've dispensed with a few myths, but how should we think about the relationship between a new theory and a current theory and a fundamental theory. Well, I think we require something like what Bohr required, which we can state more generally, which is something called the correspondence principle. This is Heinz Post, his formulation from 1971. So this is the requirement that any acceptable new theory should account for the success of its predecessor by degenerating into that theory under those conditions under which it has been well confirmed. Now I'd want to add a qualification here or a clarification. I would want to include not just success in a kind of thin sense of getting the same predictions, but actually of recreating the inferences that were relevant in the theory. So how is it that the theory was used to reason about the world successfully? And that should be something that is captured with the successor theory as well. So for example, the fact that Newtonian gravity was used to discover Neptune, there is an inference from the anomalous motion of Uranus to the fact that there must be another planet there. We would want a theory such that that inference would still be valid, not just a theory that got the same predictions for planetary motions, right? So it's a more demanding notion of success. Okay, so we want to then say we can recover the old theory as a limit of the new theory, but of course we don't want to say that across the board. It's only going to be in some domains. Our new theory, of course, is new, so it should be telling us some new things that are incompatible with the old theory. And so we also might think that the old theory was misleading in some ways. So perhaps the old theory had some aspects that we think were extraneous or weren't actually useful in representing nature. So think of the case of general relativity. The Gödel universe is a solution to the vacuum Einstein's field equations. We might not think that that's actually useful in representing anything in nature. So there'd be no reason to require that the next theory recovers that as a solution. We don't have to recover the entire solution space of general relativity. We just need to recover the parts of it that have been useful in describing nature. And similarly, we should allow that there could be new regimes in the subsequent theory or the final theory that don't have clear analogs. There can be new regimes where we didn't have a description in our earlier theory. Okay, and finally, I just want to say something about the status of what I've been calling emeritus theories. And this is a nice passage from Steven Weinberg. There was a discussion where Weinberg was criticizing Kuhn in the New York Review of Books. And this is then written in response to a letter that was after that initial article. And I think he states something nice here, which is that the predecessor theories aren't just dismissed as approximations, right? So as he says, but approximate theories are not merely approximately true. They can make a statement that refers to an approximation is nevertheless precisely true. For instance, although Maxwell's equations give only an approximate account of electric and magnetic fields, it is precisely true that the error introduced by using Maxwell's equations to calculate these fields can be made as small as one likes by considering fields that are sufficiently weak and slowly varying. This is part of the reason that Maxwell's equations are a permanent part of physical science. So it's not as if we dispense with them entirely. They're recovered in the way that Weinberg is describing here. Okay, so to wrap up this brief discussion then, so how do we think of the relationship between a new fundamental theory and an emeritus theory? Ideally, there will be empirical results in the kind of argument that I gave an example of that will force very specific revisions of our current theory. And then the correspondence principle will require that there's a kind of limiting relationship, qualified in the way I described, between the final theory and our current theory. But clearly, the devil is in the details and understanding how to take that limit, how to understanding the limiting relationship. And also, it's not clear how many opportunities we have for that sort of empirical result that we can leverage in the case of quantum gravity, as we have in earlier cases in physics. Okay, so now let me turn to the second worry, which is that somehow a theory without space and time is just fundamentally incoherent. And so what I mean by an incoherent theory is a quite specific notion, namely a theory that, if it's true, undermines the very evidence that you would take to justify it. So it's a kind of self-undermining feature. So the question then is a fundamental theory without time or without space-time incoherent in this sense? So I should be clear that in this discussion, I'm going to be borrowing an argument that was originally formulated in a somewhat different context. And so, first of all, the very notion of an empirically incoherent theory comes from Jeff Barrett, who is discussing a specific interpretation of non-relativistic quantum physics called the Bare theory. You can think of it as many worlds without the worlds. In any case, it's a theory where it's unclear that you'd have any coherent notion of evidence. And so that's why he said this particular way of thinking about quantum physics, he said, is empirically incoherent. Now, the argument I'm going to be importing, though, is from a discussion about what's called wave function realism. So this is, again, a discussion in the interpretation of quantum mechanics. And the discussion focuses on how to think about the wave function, and in particular, how to think about the wave function in a representation over configuration space. So there are some people who think you should have a realist commitment to the wave function in configuration space. Now, there's an analogous problem to what we've been discussing for quantum gravity, which is if you think that the wave function over configuration space is a real thing, that's over a, you know, for three particles, it's r to the 3n dimensional space, how do you recover localized events and real space from that picture? And so there have been arguments about the difficulty that people face in recovering space in wave function realism that I think have a parallel with the questions about recovering space and time from a fundamental theory. And so that's where I'm getting the argument, and we're going to see how this carries over then to the case of a fundamental theory. And the argument is focused on an idea, drawing on an idea from John Bell. He used this term local beables, which you can roughly think of as just physical quantities defined on bounded regions of space-time. The examples he gives are things like the electric and magnetic field. And the claim is that local beables are really essential for understanding how our theories of physics connect with our ordinary experience, and so how we relate theory and evidence. So Maudlin, in a 2007 paper, makes this very precise. He says, the evidential connection, again, between just theory and our experience, is made between the physical description and a certain class of local beables, such as the positions of macroscopic objects. The contact between theory and evidence is made exactly at the point of some local beables, beables that are predictable according to the theory and intuitively observable as well. So he's making a claim that there's an essential role for local beables in understanding how our theories connect up with the evidence we develop for them. And then the question is whether we can reconstruct local beables in our theory. So here's an attempt at an argument for incoherence, that we would have an empirically incoherent theory if we had a fundamental theory that lacked space and time. So in fundamental theories without space-time, there are no local beables at the fundamental level. The second premise, local beables are necessary to make the connection between theory and evidence. That's what we just saw Maudlin assert. And then the conclusion, the tempting conclusion to draw, would be then fundamental theories without space-time are empirically incoherent in the way that I described. Now, I'm sure none of you is convinced by this. There's obviously something missing in this argument before it would be compelling. There has to be something about why a derivation or an account of emergence would not be sufficient to answer this question, right? So obviously, if we postulate a theory without local beables, or we postulate a fundamental theory in which space-time doesn't appear as part of the fundamental ontology, we can try to derive that from that picture and give the connection that Maudlin is saying we need. So unless we have some reason to say that that kind of reasoning isn't sufficient, this argument doesn't work, right? So that's the crucial missing premise in this argument. And here's the closest Maudlin comes to explaining his view here, although, again, this is from a slightly different context in which this debate is occurring. But he says, one might also try to instead derive a physical structure with the form of local beables from a basic ontology that does not postulate them. This would allow the theory to make contact with evidence, still at the level of local beables, but would also insist that at a fundamental level, the local structure is not itself primitive. This approach turns critically on what such a derivation of something isomorphic to local structure would look like, where the derived structure deserves to be regarded as physically salient rather than merely mathematically definable. Until we know how to identify physically serious derivative structure, it's not clear how to implement this strategy. Well, I think this is really the crucial question. How would we identify physically serious derivative structure? How would we fill in this account connecting the fundamental aspects of the theory to the local Biables that are necessary for mediating the connection with evidence? But that's exactly what the accounts of emergence or limiting relationships, the correspondence principle that I was describing earlier, that's exactly what they're supposed to do. And here I'm really agreeing with Huggett and Wuthrich in their reply to modeling, but that's exactly what this account would do. If we had an understanding of a limiting relationship of a candidate theory of quantum gravity, it would give us a physically motivated understanding of how it connects up with the local Biables. And so there is a temptation, I think, to say maybe there's some a priori constraints on what would qualify as physically serious. So if we go back to Sklar's quote at the outset, we might say, maybe there's something more we should demand for something to be an appropriate derivation. And my response to that line of argument would just be, how would you justify that? What further requirement would you impose in order to call this a physically serious derivation? I think as long as we have an understanding of the limiting relationship, that should really resolve this question. So I don't think this charge of empirical incoherence is a telling one. I think it just says, again, this is something we have to accomplish by understanding the limiting relationship between the theories. But I'll say briefly, I think there is a connection with the related debate, which is a bit more subtle, which regards the nature of time and not so much focused on space-time, which is, I think there's similar questions that have been posed about the coherence of what I'll call a Parmenidean theory, namely a theory without a sense of time flowing or a sense of change. And Lee Smolin and several of his co-authors have written about this, a need for real time. And there's Richard Healy, a philosopher, has also written about this in response to the problem of time and quantum gravity. And I think the question here is analogous to what we just saw with the question about local Biables, namely, what does our temporal experience really imply regarding features of time and fundamental theory? And here, I think there's just a huge risk, which is that we have a risk that we might be neglecting a naturalistic account of how we fit in our physical environment, such that we ourselves have a role in constructing our experience, including our temporal experience. And I think if you try to say that we have to put that nature of time directly in the fundamental theory, you're neglecting the ways in which we ourselves are involved in creating the experience of time. And so this is a line that Janan Ismail and Craig Callender have pursued in different ways, that our temporal experiences emerges out of a complex set of interactions between us and the natural world. And so it's not clear that we should read off from our experience a need to assert that fundamental theory has time as a component. I realize that that was super quick, but let me move on to the final point. This is, again, I've said, first of all, that we should think of the correspondence principle and the limiting relationship between theories as crucial. Secondly, that empirical coherence isn't a telling criticism of these theories, that I think if you have an understanding of the limiting relationship, then you have an answer to the kind of worry that Maudlin raised. But I finally want to say that it isn't also the full answer. So obviously, understanding the correspondence principle or the limiting relationships between theories is only going to be a part of how we understand the final theory, right? So suppose, just grant me for a moment, that we do have an understanding of the limiting relationship between these two theories, such that we know how to recover the initial theory or the emeritus theory from the fundamental theory. So let's grant that we have that. That still would only give us partial insight into the physical significance of the full theory. It's only going to give us a window into what that theory describes. And so just as an example, think of the way we can understand the empirical content of general relativity. If you just think about the basic concept of Lorentzian geometry and how you infuse that with physical content, This is the kind of presentation, this is from a philosopher, David Malamud, but you have a set of claims linking geometric ideas, different types of curves with different types of behaviors of bodies, right? So this is hopefully familiar. I'm not going to go through it in detail, but the obviously the point is that there's some way of saying we have a way of thinking about what the Lorentzian geometry represents. We have this mapping, and you could then use the field equations and other aspects of the theory to build on these interpretive principles to understand what is the content of a specific solution, what is this content of a description of space-time and general relativity. Right, so we have these interpretive principles that allow us to say how the mathematics is related to physical systems. There's all kinds of interesting things about these. They often involve idealized statements. These involve test particles and so on. So there's a lot of interesting questions about exactly how to think about these interpretive principles. The point I want to make is actually a relatively straightforward one, which is that these principles aren't based solely on correspondence principle or limit case reasoning, right? So the way we think about these is not just based on the predecessor theory, right? That would put far too much weight on the predecessor theory in trying to interpret the full scope of the physical content of the new theory. So that might give us a hint. It might help us to articulate these interpretive principles, but these are principles, and actually in the historical development of general relativity, it was a while before we had sort of a good understanding of the full content of the theory. It's a hard-fought battle to understand exactly how to interpret the full content of the theory. And so looking at Newtonian gravity or Minkowski spacetime would help you along the way, but that isn't something that gives you the full answer. And so that's an important limitation of correspondence-style reasoning. And instead, we should think in terms of the one aspect of these interpretive principles is that we can think of them as having an overall coherence and consistency. So consider the relationship between some of these principles. So these aren't entirely independent of one another, and they're also not independent of the field equations. So they hang together well. This is, Jim Weatherall calls it the puzzle ball conjecture. The idea is that you can take a few of the aspects of the interpretation as basic and look at how it implies things about the others. So you can take the field equations as basic and derive the behavior of test particles in a particular limit as you have a tube of matter and it shrinks down, and if you satisfy the energy conditions and all kind of, it actually is a quite subtle kind of argument. You can show that the tube as it shrinks down will collapse onto a time-like geodesic. Right, so that gives you motivation for thinking that the claim that free particles follow geodesics is well justified. It fits with the field equations. And you can give other arguments of that sort where you show that these principles hang together well with other aspects of the theory. And so that kind of evaluation isn't something that really relies on the predecessor theory. It's within the theory. Once it's been formulated, you have to assess how to formulate the interpretive principles and how they hang together. And finally, of course, we want to extend to new regimes that work well beyond our initial regime. So we have to consider all kinds of new issues that arise, such as events horizons, singularities in the case of general relativity. The Newtonian analogs would have not been helpful in interpreting physically what's going on there. And similarly, we want to look for empirical tests in new regimes to see that the physical interpretation we're giving the equations actually hangs together and ends up giving us successful predictions. And so that's just to say that the principles that infuse the mathematics of general relativity with content have a lot of different sources of justification. The correspondence principle relation is not the main one. It might help as a heuristic when we're initially formulating the theory, but it's certainly not going to give us deep insights into the full structure of the theory. And so the conclusion of this section is, in order to recognize a fundamental theory as a worthy successor of general relativity, we'd have to understand the correspondence relationship between it and general relativity to say what we have is now in some sense taking over part of what general relativity gave us as a theory of space-time. But we'd have to do a lot more to understand what the theory is fully saying, right? So this would not be understanding the limiting relationship between the theories is just a very small part of the project of understanding the physical content of the theory. Okay, and I'm really going to wrap up now. I might have gone a little bit faster. I was talking quite fast, I guess. This will give us plenty of time for discussion. But just to wrap up, I've been looking at sort of three philosophical issues related to how to think about fundamental theories in the context where they no longer have space-time quantities. And the first point was just one more directed at bad philosophy of science and sort of resurrecting a different way of thinking about this, which is that we should, first of all, dispense with the philosophical myths regarding theory change, and that the correspondence between theories will shed light on the final theory, or the fundamental theory, and we should look for the possibility to leverage empirical results to make the case for specific new principles that we would incorporate in that theory. So I think those are both responses to what I saw as these bad philosophical myths of underdetermination and, sort of revolutionary theory change. Second, I argued against the idea that there's something further that would be required to understand a fundamental theory without space-time as coherent, that if we're able to actually understand the limiting relations between the theories, that should suffice to establish that it's an empirically coherent theory. Obviously, that's a huge question, how to establish the limiting relations, but I'm just saying that I don't see a further philosophical objection that has merit to this charge of empirical incoherence. And finally, that would be an amazing achievement to understand the limiting relations between a proposed fundamental theory and our current theory. It would allow us to say that it's a theory of space and time that's taking over some of what general relativity had done for us, but that's not sufficient. We would have a lot more to do to build on that partial interpretation of the new theory in order to fully understand its physical content. And I'll wrap it up there. So thank you.
I'm also keeping an eye on people online, so we have 30-something people.
Okay.
Okay, questions for, and we're gonna do some baseball here. So
Robert.
Okay, so I see Robert here, and then Carlo in the back, and then John. Okay, Robert, there you go. Don't have to throw this to you.
So thanks a lot for your talk. Could you go back a couple of slides where you had a list of questions of key issues, like length and duration?
Sorry? Oh, right, the...
Right,
yeah.
This one here. So yeah. My question is, these are all classical concepts that you're
yes.
talking about. So does quantum mechanics have to play a role here? Or can you imagine a emergent scenario without quantum? So that's my question.
Yeah, no, so I was meant to, so what I intended with this was not to say that this has to be the only aspect of a fundamental theory. This was just an illustration of the nature of interpretive principles for a theory that we know. So I could have written down a set of similar principles for quantum physics and said, here's how we understand the physical content of quantum physics. It's basically, we have a way of interpreting the theory that says, here's how the physical content is assigned to the mathematics. And so I, of course, think that when we go to a final theory, this is not going to be the set of interpretive principles. There's going to have to be a component of quantum physics in those interpretive principles. All I meant to illustrate was, when we have a physical theory and you say, here's some mathematics that I'm using, here's a Hilbert space, a projective Hilbert space, here's a set of operators, how is it that I think of that as related to something in my lab? An interpretation should give you an understanding of that linkage so that you can say, here's the physical content in the mathematics. And that's what I'm saying this describes only for general relativity, classically. And whatever we have as a fundamental theory will, of course, have to have a quantum component as well.
Yeah, thank you. Well, first of all, thank you very much. I found this was absolutely brilliant and the kind of things that a physicist would need from philosophers. I found it very strong and convincing your points, which come also as a sort of reply to objections from philosophers mm-hmm. to things that are done. So thank you very much. And my question actually also regards this third part you got at. Something struck me in your example with classical GR, which is that it was formulated in a conceptual framework that clearly was very new when it came out, mm-hmm. and it was first formulated by Einstein relying on some idealized idea of rods and clocks, mm-hmm. sort of given a priori, and very slowly, somehow, it turned out that you don't need that, and that the theory itself provides an account of the idealized clock and mm-hmm. Of the approximation of the idealized clocks. So it seems to me that you're suggesting something here, that in coming up, trying to build the quantum theory of gravity, there is the part which has to do with what you call the correspondence principle, mm-hmm. which, of course, I mean, we should know how that relates to the actual measurement in space-time we're used to. But to actually make sense of it in its own terms, mm-hmm. perhaps this can be done slowly, in a sense, and could grow once we understand how the theory works without the need of starting from day one with a complete clarity.
Yeah, so you said it more clearly than I could have, but that's certainly part of what I intended, that we don't really come to our theories with a full grasp of the physical interpretation, and I think it's a hard-won set of insights that you gradually develop over time. And so I think what we often have instead is a few points where we're relatively confident in what the theory says about a particular question. And ideally, those are relatively independent of the finer details of the interpretation, and so that we can use that as a kind of beachhead of understanding that allows us then to develop a finer understanding as we start to understand the mathematics in more detail. And if you just think about the kinds of tools that we have in studying general relativity now, conformal completions, the sort of advanced study of the causal structure and the topology, now a lot more understanding of how to deal with the difficult features of the field equations treated as partial differential equations. Like, we've just developed, the community has developed a host of new tools that just allow us to ask better questions and also continually lead to refinements of how we think of the physical content of the theory. But you're right, it's important that we can start off without having this sort of fully beautiful picture, and that's how we have to start, so.
Thank you.
So I have a few questions, I think Laurent is, but I just want to, I forgot, we usually had this tradition of starting with the students, and I just don't see, okay, so I do see two, let's see, so I guess.
Hello, in one of your slides, you had a very strange idea that the sense of flow or time is a artificial byproduct of the human brains, right?
Yeah, so I didn't hear you fully, but
said time is a artificial byproduct of human brains. It's not something fundamental. So are we going to ever be able to test that? Because whatever we do, we are there.
Right. So let me be a little bit more careful in stating this, because I think there's sort of two distinct claims. One is, I think in general, in thinking about the nature of the... So in thinking about the logical character of how our experience contributes to our knowledge, I think we have to think of that in conditional terms. What I mean by that is we have to think of it as conditional on the way we think of ourselves as interacting in a physical environment. So anytime I think I have an experience that gives me evidence for something, I think implicitly I have a bunch of assumptions about I'm an agent in the world, I'm interacting with things in certain ways. So if you're looking at an experimental apparatus, you say, I'm a reliable measuring, I can see that the measuring device has a certain reading, my visual field is reliable, and so on. So that's just the starting point, that we have to think about our experience in sort of conditional terms. And so when we think about our experience of time, I think we do have to take seriously that we're embodied agents living in the world. And so some of the features that we experience of time might be a result of the way we experience the world, right? And so that just means it's hard to make a direct inference from I experience time in a certain way to the fundamental physical theory must represent time in that way. And again, I find it counterintuitive. It's much easier to say Nyesh has a blue shirt. Is the blue in the shirt, or is it a product of the way I'm interacting with the light that's bouncing off his shirt? In that kind of context, it's much easier to say, well, there's a secondary quality of color that's partly constituted by me as a perceiver. I find it much harder to say the same thing about time, but I think we have to be worried about that the experience of time might have similar features.
Can another question for my students, younger students. Okay, there's one at the end. I'm gonna give my athletic ability.
Oh, nice.
Hey, hi. Well, I'm not a student, but almost, so maybe. Or maybe in this topic I would be definitely a student. So I have a question about the discussion on leveraging empirical evidence. So I, as far as I understand, as a physicist working on quantum gravity, rather than empirical evidence, we have paradoxes that we face. So a paradox a paradox per se gives questions rather than an empirical answer to those questions.
Right.
So I wonder how would Ehrenfest and Poincaré in 1911-12 would address a paradox rather than the suggested answer of the paradox.
So I think the using thought experiments involving black holes, for example, I think that's it's a way of manifesting conflicts between principles by seeing how they apply in a concrete instance. I mean, obviously, the great advantage they had is that they actually could also check and see exactly what the implications were of the black body radiation that they observed. But I think of thought experiments as being similar in some ways. You want to have a very clear context where you can understand the implications of different formalisms and isolate the conflict and try to figure out which principles are at issue. And if you have a lot of, I mean, again, this is, so I think like the entropy for black holes, the Bekenstein-Hawking formula, often serves as a kind of touchstone for quantum gravity, where there's a lot of agreement that there's a right answer, and then you can ask, have you gotten the right answer? I mean, obviously it'd be richer and better to have sort of empirical results that had that same character of saying, not only is this something that everyone agrees on, but it's something that nature has delivered to us.
Because in some applications that I have in mind of your equation, TI or part of it plus
right.
empirical evidence, we rather do the opposite in quantum gravity. We rather postulate TF and try to go backward, right?
Right.
And when you don't have the empirical evidence that allow you to link, it may be harder because to the same paradox there could be a plethora of answers, right? So
it's a much shakier game, right? Because you're so influenced by the theory and the way you formulated that you might that can shape the way you analyze the debate in a lot of ways. So okay.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you for this beautiful talk. And so as a student of philosophy, I'm here to learn, but I'm also a practitioner of quantum gravity that is really committed to the discovery of quantum gravity. And there was an element of that I use a lot in my practice that somehow didn't appear in your description. I want to know why or how you feel about it. So you mentioned how much TF needs to approximate the final theory needs to approximate the one we have right now. And 100% with that. But also the thing is that in my understanding of history and every fundamental breakthrough discovery, what we also have, and that's the thing I, as a practitioner, I focus on, we also have always one observable which in TF exists, and in TI would be completely wrong. And let me give you a beautiful historical example, because I think this is the mechanism between any breakthrough discovery. So this is the example of the Arago spot, right?
Yeah.
So what happened there? Here we have, and we have the three actors that create a breakthrough. We have Fresnel, that is theorist, that say, what theory? Light is wave. Then we have Poisson, which is one of, you mentioned that person, that is really the person that really understands the previous paradigm and says, and Fresnel is the young guy and Poisson is the old established one. And, and Poisson tells Fresnel, you're completely wrong. And I know why you're wrong, because your theory is going to predict something absolutely completely silly, which is the Arago spot, which is essentially behind the screen, there will be always at the center a bright spot. And that's obviously completely wrong. And then, hopefully, you have somebody courageous. I don't know why. Maybe he didn't care about, because Poisson was very powerful at that time.
Right.
And I could have shut off completely. And for some reason, I would love to understand, Arago didn't care about Poisson and say, oh, that's an interesting experiment to do, an impossible experiment. And he found the Arago spot. And that's it.
Yeah.
Right? This is the making. And every single breakthrough is always about that. It's about finding the impossible observable, the new theory doesn't predict some 10 to the 15 mm-hmm. correction. It predicts something impossible. So it was not part of your, or maybe I missed it.
Yeah, no. It's just a matter of deciding what to focus on. So I agree that that's an essential component. When you have a new theory, you want to look at what is distinct and new and what gives the sharpest contrast with the earlier results, right? And so there's a lot of historical cases, like the one you mentioned is wonderful, and I don't actually know that much about the historical background. So that, those kinds of cases are wonderful, and yes, that's certainly something that people look for. I just didn't happen to focus on that. So yeah, it's an important part of the historical development and a very important part of gaining confidence in the new theory. So.
What are the empirical experimental results that can lead to new physical in quantum gravity that can lead to new physical principles?
That's a very good question. I'm probably not the person in the room that has the best answers to that. So I agree that there's a need to look for empirical results. I'm curious whether there are any cases of the kind of leverage that I mentioned that we can gain from current empirical results. But I don't have a good answer. I'm not somebody who's aware of exactly what kinds of experiments we can attain. That's not my gig. But I would expect people in the audience might actually have better answers to what's a feasible experiment that could be done.
I should just say, I don't know of any.
Okay, well. Okay.
I think this is, that's a fascinating discussion, but, yes, thank you. So, wonderful. So, one last question we have online, but just to follow up on this, what experiments could shed light on quantum gravity? That if you have ideas about that, come to our meetings. It's upstairs in the ballroom. We have discussions in an hour. So we're going to discuss that today and tomorrow for the rest of the week. So all ideas are welcome. So the question online, Andrew.
The necessary conditions.
Yes.
Well, I mean, so, I mean, we certainly have time existing as we experience it as an approximation. You're asking, like, what would the necessary condition for it to be exist in a fundamental theory? I don't know yeah. that's something that there's, like, a good a priori answer to. I think.
Okay. Can I pitch these at you? I see time as being a change against versus a reference change. But that could happen. Change can happen in the universe. You have to have sentience. Someone has to be aware of it. But even that's not enough. Sentience has to be concerned, motivated. So to my mind, the conditions might be, once again, a change versus a reference change. That's what time is. That there needs to be an observer sentience and there needs to be a motivation. Humans, we have mortality. That makes us very interested in day and night and things like this. It makes us very interested in it. My point, I'll just go on to a second point because it's the third question I want to ask you. The second point, I'll just make it quickly, is that time is very human-centric. We get our, if you think about 60 seconds, where that comes from, 60 minutes, it's about a hand, 12 joints, 5 fingers. That's how we came to 60. We have day and night. We look at time began for us as periods around the sun and the rotation of the planet. My point is that time is a very human-centric phenomenon, if you like. And my question to you, my last question would be, the universe, if a universe is infinite and absolutely uniform, what relevance does time have to the universe?
Again, there's different ways of formulating these questions about time. So first of all, if the universe is infinite and uniform, it can still be an evolving FLRW model, which has a cosmic time that actually has a well-defined time parameter in it. I agree with the worry that a lot of the aspects of time that we take as fundamental might be reflections of our own experience in a strong sense. And so that's why I said, I think this is a really tricky kind of place. So I don't want to impose, some philosophers want to say there's a priori conditions on what the nature of space and time must be in order for us to have experience. I don't think that that's well motivated, and I think we should be open-minded to the possibility that a fundamental physical theory might represent time in a completely different way, or that the features of time we associate with our experience are more like time is experienced in subsystems, and that it's very radical, but I think as long as we can recover our experience, there's no a priori argument that tells against that.
And on that note, thank you very much, Andrew, for the excellent question. Thanks, everybody, and thanks, Chris, for this wonderful talk.